You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.
We are burning down the house here on Sunday, 31st July, 2011. My birthday, thank you. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host. Here we are. It's the middle of summer. Tempers rise high. It's not surprising that the American Revolution, or as the British would have it, the American War of Rebellion, was fermented in the heat of a Philadelphia summer. We have with us the writer and architect duo Dickinson. I hear you there.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Are you 39 again?
I'm 38 and holding, thank you.
I like that.
Yeah. Also in the studio, who may or may not have something to say, not exactly as Vox Populi, Voice of the People, but as an informed voice, we also have the architect Matt Arnold.
Happy birthday, Curtis.
Hey, thank you so much.
Good to hear
And thank
voice,
you for being here. The reason that I wanted to talk with Duo from his not very hot, I'm supposing, summer retreat someplace along Lake Champlain... You suck, man. You know, vacations are for wimps.
I know. I allow myself 6 days a year, and it's too much.
Well, I'm so glad that we could reach you through the wonder of telecommunication. The catalyst piqued my imagination and wanting to talk with Duo was an article that's in the summer 2011. Magazine of the Boston Society of Architects, our friends to the north, at www.architects.org/architectureboston/articles. Really dense, but in the good way, article that Duo has written about regulation and relevance, a reciprocal relationship. And I just want to read a couple things that you wrote, and then you can defend it or expand upon it. One, that you said back in the day, and we understand when that was, probably before any of us was born, architecture was viewed as the mother of the arts, this somewhat new age description. Well, what's old is new again. Aptly describes the sense that the practitioner of the mother of the arts was someone who had an all-encompassing knowledge, we hope, and open-ended skill set, we hope. A professional who could absorb, control, and finally triumph over perceived limits of buildability, environmental impact, and cultural relevance. And you note quite wisely that since World War II, the perception of the architect as the open-minded yet innovative leader in the mode of, say, Thomas Jefferson has been deeply compromised. And that, furthermore, to our current times or recent times, somewhere along the way, it became unfashionable for architects to be concerned with very many things that were not of the fine arts world. And you cite some epic fails, which we can talk about. Before we really get into the pithy things, I want to let you talk a little bit about whether you think that this is a result of architects' failure, or rather as a matter of the current atmosphere that we're seeing writ large with the budget crisis.
Yeah,
as political distrust.
I actually think it's you know, I cite architects as the really kind of an exemplar, undeniable, of I think a much larger trend in all professions that has to do with a lot of things. But if you look at doctors and you look at lawyers, there's an enormous commonality of going from the informed generalist to little flocks and gangs and circles of hyper specialists, and seemingly this has to do a great deal with probably just more information being promulgated. But it probably, to me, and I think this is the root of a lot of what goes on in architecture, there is this reaction to risk avoidance, to the idea that as things get more litigious, as the world becomes more media driven and epic fails aren't really swept under the carpet, they're exploded into public consciousness, you have architects responding as a profession, independent of aesthetics, into extreme specificity of deniability, where they can have any number of consultants to buttress their defendability of their designs or their attitudes, or even just the building process they're engaged in.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think, but the dark side of that, the part of that which I think is specific to our little tiny bailiwick of, you know, under 100,000 people trying to make the world, generally trying to make the world a better place, is the sort of collapse of diversity of ideological, aesthetic, and just open-minded practice of education and celebration of built work, which has taken a profession which is like other professions, fracturing into hyper-specialization, but made it even more out of touch and even less relevant for average people by having at the core of its identity, of its own personal identity when it looks in the mirror, being way over to the fine arts side. And it becomes this inaccessible, arcane, and now highly regulated and overseen group of people trying just to build buildings.
Or maybe not. Well, there are a couple of different threads that I'd like to pursue with you today, which, by the way, those of you who are listening for the first time or the second time, know this. This is not rehearsed. This is not Charlie Rose. Duo and I have not discussed this before. Duo does not know what I want to talk about. He only knows that I want to talk to him about his article. And we've spoken frequently of the runway fashion trends in architecture, but something that you focused on, which was cancerous, viral spread of regulation that interests me too. I think it's all politics. I'll tell you why. Because three, I think we've lost the friendship of our constituency. While we rephrase our thoughts, let's have a little cream. Thank you.
My big
Welcome back to... Here we are, back again with Duo Dickinson, Matt Arnold, I'm Curtis B. Wayne. We're talking about regulation and respect. We're not in a unique position amongst the licensed professions. And the third thing that I wanted to talk about from your pithy and thoughtful and thought-provoking essay in the Boston Society of Architects magazine is that it's not just us who are getting the pantsuit of us. It's the doctors.
Yeah.
And I think it's because the trial lawyers have got the politicians in their pocket.
Oh, there's absolutely no doubt there's a symbiotic relationship between regulation and the creation of wealth for lawyers. There's no doubt about it. But I do think that in a democracy, the loudest voice usually gets the most attention. And obviously, lawyers and other special interests have a very loud voice of finance, throwing a lot of money in front of people that make policy. But the truth is, I also think that if doctors, architects, and any number of other people that are seen as real targets of profit centers of law firms.
Well, sure. I mean, the people who are most trusted, if anything goes wrong, it's not perfectly as expected.
Right.
Like, we should live forever, and our houses should cost nothing to heat, and the roof should never leak. Then, therefore, because the expectations are so high that we got to pay.
Well, it's true, and I do think, but I do think that the window of opportunity is twofold. Number one, obviously, the lawyering has become sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy of priming the pump to get vehicles to sue. But I also think that we have not done ourselves as architects and as doctors, and most of my doctor friends say this too, those professions have not done ourselves any favors in the way we often are seen to treat those who we serve. We actually treat them as if they are privileged to have us in their presence,
right,
and as opposed to us being served.
Exactly, Duo. The doctors got hammered for lack of bedside manner a long time ago. Most of our colleagues haven't understood that yet.
Yep.
I think this current depression in which we find ourselves will have reformed a lot of the arrogant SOBs in our profession.
Well, I see it already. What's very fascinating to me, and this is a subject of a whole other show, is that
already, listeners, he's wangling for another show.
But I'm a relentless self-promoting whore. But anyway, what I do think is fascinating to me is that it's dawning on people right now, the whole country, not architects, not doctors, everybody, is that very similar to the mindset in, say, 1936, this isn't going away anytime soon. This isn't one of these things where in the late 1990s, early 20s, we could have a technological boom pull us out of a little recession, or you could have a housing boom pull us out of a recession, or you could have some sort of amazing invention pull us out of a recession like the internet.
Exactly. This is not the dot-com bust.
This is not
the stock market crash of 1987.
No, this
is 1929 all over again, but in a different way.
And I think just like that created a very interesting generation that saw what money really meant and actually saw what what families could really do for each other and also looked at government in a different way. I think this recession we're just beginning to see is, and somebody by the way got very angry at me and said, you cannot call this you cannot call this something the second. You really have to call this the Great Recession with a capital G and a capital R. It really is the Great Recession. And I think there's truth to that because of the sustain it has, and also there's not a single place in the entire United States which is not in some level of recession, and many places are in far worse states than we are here in the Northeast.
Then why not call it the Depression of 2008?
You absolutely could. I mean, that could be the next level of it, because when unemployment's going to be over 10% probably next year, I don't see us having any sense other than looking at professions like architecture, which are viewed as being somewhat important but unessential, and professions like doctoring, where many doctors make hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars for doing very routine, simple procedures. I think you'll have a lot of people turn on those professions and basically demand redress, and I think that's a natural human reaction. And the beauty of it is that with architecture anyway, we can look at ourselves and say, how have we created our own irrelevancy? How have we actually added to the common sense that we are not worthy of the value we have of ourselves? Why is our self-value not reflected in the common perception?
Well, I have my answer to that.
Go for it.
I have my answer, and that is that after the Second World War, I know that you're averse to the notion of the Second Great Depression, but after the Second War, European and Pacific War, in which we were embroiled. Our most eminent conveyors, I mean architecture schools, okay? Harvard became headed by Gropius, whom we all revere. And the Armour Institute, which became the Illinois Institute of Technology, was headed by Meese.
Yep.
And both of them came out of the First World War, post-war ethos of just let us make form, because they were reacting against the eclectic sentiment that had been pretty much, except for the Vienna secession, the accepted mode of architecture. And although Meese was structurally adept, he was a good engineer. He understood engineering. Any Gropius building could have been done in wood, concrete, steel. It didn't matter. It was all about plastic space. And those of you who have gone to architecture school will understand that. Those of you who are civilians, and there are a lot of you who listen to this program, what I mean is about the manipulation of space, the sequence of spaces, the bending and twisting of enclosing volumes. Mostly Gropius, because Harvard's way up in the pecking order over IIT, nevertheless, had a really serious impact on the people who were responsible for some of the great fails.
Exactly.
Mr. Cobb of I.M. Pei Frey, what's their current name? I.M. Pei's successor.
Oh, gosh.
Pei Cobb Frey.
Yeah, Pei Cobb Frey.
Pei Cobb Frey. Mr. Cobb, who did the design direction for the Hancock Tower in Boston, which was the largest failure of a glass skin which we will ever see, because the arrogance of the architects was, well, the glass suppliers will figure it out, and the glass people said, well, you designed it, we'll build it.
Yeah.
And it was the largest, eventually, plywood-clad skyscraper in the world.
It's sort of performance art, sort of like a nice calico quilt.
And that led to a sense that we can't trust these people.
Well, you know, I think you're absolutely dead on.
Let's just take a little break right here. Here's a little song from Thomas the Tank Engine about rules and regulations. rules and regulations now. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Rules and regulations. Rules and regulations now. Your children are too young to remember Thomas the Tank Engine.
Oh, not mine.
No?
No, my God. We had so many Thomas products out there. Oh, my God. It was unbelievable.
Oh, I had the entire rail yard. Matt Arnold has something to say about the codes.
Well, Duo, I wanted
come
to
closer,
Duo,
please.
I wanted to ask you, as hard as it would be to say roll back some of these proliferating regulations, what do you think of the idea of asking for a 10-year moratorium on changes to the building code? In other words, it's good enough today. What happens between today and tomorrow that makes it not good enough tomorrow?
Oh, the green building code. The international green building code.
We have accepted the idea of a code change cycle.
Yeah, I know.
Now, that's absurd.
Well, you know what I want to get really wacky political on this show, but what is really fascinating is that when you go broke, and you can go broke financially, or you can go broke intellectually, you can go broke emotionally. When you go broke and you bottom out and you hit the wall, you begin to say, why is all this happening? And the truth is, right now in Washington, you have about 500 people that essentially made their living by kicking the can down the road and essentially getting trillions and trillions of dollars of non-existent money financing their own re-election every year by getting things for people that nobody had any money for. You similarly have codes that are making up, that are operating under autopilot, that are essentially saying, well, we all have to earn a living. All these code consultants, all of these groups that have formed new codes and reform other codes, what ends up happening is that when nobody's building anything anymore, and when nobody's making any money building anything anymore, there is a pretty strong impetus to say, well, you know, the buildings really aren't falling down, and nobody's really being, you know, killed in buildings by dint of incompetent codes these days. Do they really need to be revised every single year, and do we really need to have huge new overlays of oversight on everybody all the time, 24/7, to ever increasing degree?
Well, sure, absolutely. Otherwise, all of these governing agencies, they don't have a reason to exist.
Here's my point. My point is, if you change the rules every time someone rolls the dice in a game, you ever played that game Flux? It's great, but if you change the rules every time you design another building, the odds are not greater that you'll do it right. The odds are greater that you'll do it wrong. If you leave the rules alone, I'm not saying they're not perfectible, but the desire to perfect them every year, every 3 years, is creating ignorance. It's not creating more safety.
It's also creating worse buildings on one level, too.
And secondly, it's absolutely clear that all these regulations at their core conspire, and I believe deliberately, to increase costs, which means we can do less with what our resources are as regulations increase. Our ability to satisfy our needs decreases because we are able to build absolutely less.
Well, I want to, in that article in Architecture Boston AB, I cite the most egregious example of this I've ever encountered in my 32 years being an architect, and that is, we're doing a house in California, and I'll be visiting it in a week, and that county just south of San Francisco is known, it's San Mateo County, is known as really the mother of almost all regulatory oversight illegal entities. And we had a site that was buildable as of right. There were no special exceptions. There was nothing with the site that had anything other than code compliant aspects to its zoning fit, and also all the environmental regulations you could ever imagine. And because of the nature of the code review process, we had to hire 13 consultants, including myself and obviously the lawyer, so maybe 10 additional code consultants that would normally be seen in a house. This is just a house now, in a house that would be built as of right, a special, wonderful house. But those consultants cost $600,000 in services to enable a very wonderful building to be built, but a building that is in no way impacting 95% of the engineering and code review requirements that were imposed on it. And it was an as-of-right building that took 2 years to go through a normal, straight-ahead, no special exceptions permitting policy. And that's when what happens when you have an out-of-control desire for control. It's sort of oxymoronic. But at the same time, you have, I think, and this is where I think the feet falls, the guilt falls at our feet as architects. You have architects which didn't scream loud enough and call the question loud enough and educate themselves well enough and demonstrate the capacity to prevent errors well enough that there wasn't some street cred to all of this that allowed this to get through a democratically elected government.
Yeah. Well, two things here, Duo. For the purposes of education, if you would consider perhaps divulging what the architectural plus engineering fee was?
Yes. It will be probably total less than 10%.
Well, in total dollars as compared with the $600,000 of everybody else?
That represented approximately all in half.
So the AE fee was about 600 also?
No. 300 of the 600.
Oh. So the AE fee was half of the total fees.
Yes.
On the project.
Yes.
And that represented how much of the total cost?
The total cost, it probably represents 20, soft costs of 20 to 25% for an as-of-right house.
Well, wait, 25% soft costs of...
In other words, the total budget, all the consultants, the soft costs, are over 20%, which for an as-of-right house is absurd.
They should be around 10 to 12%.
Yeah.
Well, they would be if he hadn't had to hire all those folks.
Right.
Bingo.
To say,
but that was all right. So, what exists in San Mateo County, for whatever reason, is a lack of trust, or
bingo.
I would like to say is that we are no longer the friends of the rule makers. I don't know if they're legislators or bureaucrats or what. Before this program went on, there was the Heritage Radio Network program, We Dig Plants, and I was chatting with the host of that, and Alice, who's one of the hosts, asked me, what are we going to talk about? And I said, well, I'm going to bitch and moan about regulation. And she said, that sounds like politics.
Mm.
And that's what you always talk about. Which is funny, because actually design is, in a certain way, a political act, and politics is all about friendship. And
it's about money.
Well, money could be
about money helps make friendships, I will tell you that.
Well, I mean, you could take the point of view that politics is about money, or that politics is about affiliations. And now I'm going to go all totally Marin County on you.
Yes.
I want to read a little bit from the 13th century poet Rumi, which I found very humorous, apropos of what you were saying about certifications and other assurances that everything is okay. I'm not going to read the entire thing because it's very long, but I think we've lost the friendship of the regulators. The poem, as translated recently, is, what we hear in a friend's voice. If you are my soul's friend, what I say won't be just an assertion. You may hear me at midnight saying, come out in the dark and don't be afraid. Nearness and kinship are assertions, but the sound of a voice is not. The delight a friend feels when he hears a friend's voice brings all that matters. There are those who hear within a voice, the essence being said, and there are those who can't. To a man dying of thirst, you hand a cup of spring water. Will he demand a certificate saying this liquid is of the aqueous variety? Does an infant ask his mother to validate the breast? They shouldn't be asking us to validate the breast.
Well, and I got to tell you, Curtis, this comes full circle back to what you were talking about earlier and what you've talked about on this program before, which is this bizarre, and I do find it bizarre, freight train or super tanker as it's sailing into really off a cliff of architects essentially removing themselves from and intentionally removing themselves and holding themselves in contradiction to any sort of contact with popular culture or even just common human sentiment. It becomes as if the people that are paying for and the many, many more people that are using the buildings that we design are held in this contempt that they simply shouldn't be able to understand what we're doing, because if they do truly understand our buildings, then somehow we've failed because we really aren't going to the highest and most cutting-edge sensibility of transformative design that will lead everyone in the world to a new reality that really only architects can see and implement. And what that does is say to people on the most basic terms, you are not one of us. You have an agenda that literally threatens us, just like the EPA was formed to regulate polluters, just like all the regulations that were intensely imposed over nuclear power after
Get
Fremont
back to
Island.
Stop. Pollution. Yep. If the people who were making the chemical and owned the plants also owned the unintended aspects of just dumping it and it's somebody else's problem,
yep.
Well, that's all of a piece with... Matt has something to say. Just let me finish, because we say we'll just give form, and how it's built is somebody else's problem. Because if we looked at the entirety of what we're creating in the built environment, does it use a lot of energy? Does this source of power that we're using create a lot of smog? I mean electricity. I mean a lack of awareness of the resources required to create a structure. I mean specifically the contortions of the stuff that the top of the pops right now is Zaha Hadid, and you can't build her buildings.
She's not an architect. That's beside the point.
She's a designer whose people. Whose staff who are architects turn into drawings and they build this stuff and it's structurally confounding, which requires a lot of energy and resources in terms of raw materials to create this contorted thing, and when you look at it, then it's like a Fabergé egg writ large on the landscape because it was very precious to create.
Let me just interrupt for 1 second, because I can tell you that you're absolutely correct in everything you are saying, and the response of the fine arts community that creates these buildings are, these are works of fine art, and as one person objecting to my article said, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright didn't say that all good design leaks. He said architecture is fine art and should not be left out in the rain. Now, the thing which really...
Well, that,
really
that I'm sure he
really
said
brought,
that. I'm sure he said that when he moved to Scottsdale, where it never rains.
Well, the one thing I just want to bring into this is everything you said was totally correct. But the other huge dead moose on the architect's table of blind following other architects who are blind is that the people that actually use your buildings actually care if your buildings are useful.
And they have no voice.
Well, I'm going to bring
And they have no voice in the popular architectural
press. I'm going to bring up the building at Cooper Square that guy did.
Oh, my God.
That guy got a lot of money, and he spent a fortune. He probably could have built 3 buildings for what he spent
Tom
on it.
Tom Main's project for 41 Cooper Square.
I don't know his name.
Yeah, you don't want to know his name.
It's a school. It's a school. And they didn't put any bulletin boards in the school. Okay? Now, that means they are incompetent to perform the services that they took money for.
Yeah, but he just wanted to make a statement.
That's
somehow.
Fine. Make a statement, but not on my dime. The Code of Hammurabi...
I don't give them any money
The first building code...
Because of projects like that.
...is the Code of Hammurabi. And it says that if you build a wall, a retaining wall, and it's not... And the owner's son falls and dies, your son is forfeit as well. That kind of stuff in the code is the way it makes things work. Because all of a sudden, everybody takes it personally. What... we've done is
so you're
make
saying
it
that
impersonal.
Because there are no bulletin boards in a school, it's the equivalent of it falling on somebody.
No, it's
practically
the point is
practically it doesn't work as a school.
It's not
right.
a school. It's
that's
not
cool.
a school. It's
well,
not a school.
Buildings,
that's all.
Can we get a little bit? Can we get a little real with the listeners who are not all architects? Is that the essential truth is that two things are promulgating an overriding sensibility of architects talking to architects. It is the schools of architecture and it is the architectural press. And I'm extremely proud that Architecture Boston, this little magazine, has actually gone out on a limb for the last couple of years and is calling a spade, and basically, because I think the profession's in crisis economically, is holding up a mirror saying, this is what's really, people, this is how we really have perceived ourselves and how that's impacted our profession.
Good for them.
And what is an amazingly bizarre reality is there was a time, and it wasn't that long ago, when books and courses and competitions and magazines were focusing on how architects design buildings not only to be beautiful, but to respond to the context and to the requirements and to budgets and to the environment.
Yeah,
and what we really have now is a sort of a bizarre twin-headed hydra of form that has no meaning, and then in a giant growing industry of environmental regulation and prescription that gives them some kind of fig leaf of relevance that they use quote-unquote less energy or are greener than other buildings, even though they might cost twice as much to build.
And at the same time, magazines like Dwell make their buck on stuff that looks good. Jack, could we have the next track, please?
Welcome This is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Tuesday at noon, Dave Arnold, the author of CookingIssues.com, will discuss new and innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients. Call in with your own questions to see if Dave and the crew can solve your cooking issues. Again, that's Tuesdays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
Burning Down the House. I'm Curtis B. Wayne with Duo Dickinson and Matt Arnold. You know, so on one hand, we've got the magazines that want to push all this fashion stuff. On the other hand, we're trying to do the right thing.
Well, that's why I like you, Curtis. We basically think the same way. And what is this strange dynamic? I don't know, probably a thousand architects.
Let me be clear, I would say that I like
950 of them as people. And I would also say that everything that I find just ridiculous about the LEED movement is not the LEED movement itself, because that's actually one of these movements that's based in conscience, that basically they know
absolutely
that things are not good. And actually every single wetlands commission, historic district, architectural review board, every single regulatory group that springs up, they're springing up with the best of intentions. They're springing up with the idea that we want to make this place better, and somehow the architects are somewhere else.
Well,
and it is one of these, it's this perception issue, which is based on facts. Sadly.
Well, Duo, I have only ever had good results with architectural review boards.
Because me too.
Because
me too.
I just tell them what we're trying to accomplish, and I talk about it in real terms. I mean,
exactly.
If I just started spouting Eisenmanian... for those of you who are civilians, Peter Eisenman is a very important theorist of the last 30 years, and he's an old man now, and we don't listen to him anymore, but I learned a lot from him when I was a student, and before he was too big for his britches, psychologically and physically, and I owe a great debt of service to his teaching early on, but he writes the most dense bullshit that means nothing except to excite other people who are looking for the emperor's new clothes in some architectural writing. And those people get off on some weird head trip. And I'm not interested in weird head trips. I wasn't interested in weird head trips in 1969 when I did not go to Woodstock. Truth be told, my parents wouldn't let me, but that's okay.
There you are.
I've gotten over it. But and I'm not interested in weird philological head trips that purport to be architectural theory that are hung on the star of Noam Chomsky or Jacques Derrida.
Well, it ends up happening with many, many social movements.
I mean, it's a time to give us some truth, you know.
You got it. And I think when you reach this sort of the breaking point of economics, it's a great time to basically call the question on a lot of the crap that gets accepted because you go along to get along. And when you think about it, what I find fascinating is you look at architecture, at what it could mean to people. It has a great deal of potential salvationary impact for people that can actually hear the bright message of controlling your physical environment and actually making where you live and where you work and where you, what city you are, just an uplifting and interesting place that accepts diversity and innovation and actually experimentation, all those good things. Or it can be a place where it's you, the people that live in the community, are looking at the people that are designing these things who are really only talking to themselves. And if you actually look at psychotherapy and you look at religion and you look at any of these sort of wonderful transformative non-essential things, you will find that they do trend towards the practitioners talking to themselves and distancing themselves from the vast rest of humanity that in theory what they are doing is designed to help. And they make themselves a rarefied group of people that really only make themselves happy and make other people feel like fools because they can't hear that dog whistle that only the other dogs can hear.
I love that analogy, you know. Dog whistle architectural theory.
Well, it's true. The ears perk up for the people that can hear it, and it's very few people that can hear it. And I think that the thing which I'm sensing right now, your show, other things that are happening around the country, is that you get to a point where you just can't make more excuses. You just can't say for the 50 millionth time, no, the emperor really isn't naked. He's got this incredibly great satin robe on. Can't you see it? No, the emperor really is naked. There have been horrible failures. Many, many bad things have been done.
And yet, Duo, Dwell keeps, you know, do you know about the blog Unhappy Hipsters?
I have heard of it, and I want to go see it.
No, you got to look at it because
I have heard of it. Oh no, somebody sent me pictures from it, and it's hilarious.
Yes.
Here's the thing, Duo. What you're arguing for is good design.
Yeah.
Somebody has hijacked the idea that design has nothing to do with function, and that's where we went wrong. And people think that when we talk this way, we're against good design. We're not. We're in favor of it. It's just that we perceive the full spectrum of design instead of just a tenth of some little part in the ultraviolet. We're seeing the whole thing.
Well, I come from a tiny little community, which is the residential design community, and we have a little conference we do every year, and it's part of a thing called Reinvention. And last year we had kind of a hold a mirror in front of the face of our profession gathering, and somebody said, who in this room, about 110 architects, who actually has more work this year than they've had at any time in their career? And I raised my hand. A wonderful architect, John DeForest, raised his hand from Seattle, and another architect from Virginia, and I'm spacing on his name now, raised his hand. And I know them personally, and we are the three architects in the room that have essentially based our entire practices on using the families that live in our homes as the inspiration for what we do. The idea is that most architects that design homes or traditionally have thought about them as an ATM machine to fund great ideas that you have for them. And the truth is that there is a future in architecture in general if you widen the lens a little bit and not only think about, you know, what the thing looks like and what the form is, because I love interesting forms and buildings and abstractions and all that stuff is wonderful, but when it basically ends up doing that artful dance to the exclusion of basic technological reality and cost, but mostly exclusion of the context in which it's built or the actual needs of the people that are using it, it ceases to be architecture and simply is sculpture. Nothing wrong with sculpture. Love sculpture. But when people think of architects as not being architects but as sculptors and are making these huge, unbelievably expensive sculptures in their town, they're going to view view them differently than if they are a partner to make our community a better place to live. It's a very different perception, and that's where regulation, law, and society imposes its protective grasp on our profession to prevent us from ruining the lives of the innocent people that elect people to make laws.
You've just made a peak sentiment, and I can't say you leave me speechless, do I?
Well, you know what's really interesting?
No, really. I mean, it's like
I'm
really happy that you, who are specialists in single family housing, you three out of thousands,
110.
Yeah, well, so less than 2%.
Yep.
We're about 2.25%. Anyway, I'm glad that you're doing better than you ever did. I'm glad that the Great Recession version 2.0, which you're about.
I kind of think of it as the Great Clarification.
Distilling, yeah.
Well, we can't do this again. We can't allow this to happen. But I don't know. It gets back to politics. Unless we architects become political and say, no, you regulators need to look at capital markets a little bit more carefully.
Yeah. Well, Dodd-Frank...
Yeah, you know, I was part of that run-up. I did not know that Credit Suisse was flipping subprime shit into the mortgage stream, but I knew that they were flipping their positions and not holding them. And I was in a position to know on the very large residential development scale, but they were doing it all across the board. But I'm not a political animal. And,
well, I think what ends up happening.
I like my paycheck.
It's true. Well, I think what ends up happening is that when you lose sight of what the ultimate purpose of your profession is, you think about the word profession. It's what you profess, and in other words, you should have a conviction that you profess. When that conviction becomes making money and only making money, or in the case of architects, making fine art and only making fine art, when that profession becomes that narrow, the distortions resonate to the point where they can't be ignored and they collapse of their own weight. And you've got the greatest example in the economic world of the last 3 years, where huge distortions happened so that very few people can make a huge amount of money. And the irony, the enormous irony that makes me angry every day of my life, is that the one thing that I've dedicated my profession is to make homes, and basically one building type, the American home, was used, and its emotional pull on people and the ethical pull of everybody deserves to own their own home and all these high-minded, wonderful, pluralistic aspects were manipulated to take money out of the pockets of hundreds of millions of people. It affects squeeze it into the pockets of a few thousand people and tank the entire world's economy, because we love our homes so much, value them as these sacred objects that deserve a great deal of effort and money and wealth, and we use that definite basic human emotion and wrecked the world's economy because of greed.
Yes.
And it's amazing.
But, let's look at what tanked the economy. What tanked the economy was that people lent people on aspiration, and when the aspirational market tanked, their own aspirations were no longer supportable because their own income subsided. Here, I would like to close with a little bit more from the same Rumi poem, which I give up as an aspiration for all of us architects. When a true human being appears in a community thirsty for the taste of soul, they immediately hear in the voice the meaning of God is near. Let's go out with Give Me Some Truth, the next track. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short head, yellow belly, son of tricky dickies. Gonna mother her the top, so me for just a pocket full of hope. Money for dough. Money for
thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
Finger on the Pulse and City Winery are proud to present the Summer Barbecue Blowout Festival, August 6th, from noon to 4 p.m. The barbecue is happening at City Winery, located at 155 Varick Street in New York City. Restaurants featured at this event are Empire Mayonnaise, Van Dag, Momofuku Milk Bar, Imperial No. 9, Mile End, Mexi-Q, Kraft, Dizzy's Club, Coca-Cola, The Meatball Shop, and Dos Toros. Providing the soundtrack for the day are Midnight Magic, Pewter Magic, New Villager, Punches, Ducky, DJ Autobot, and the Snacky Tune DJ. VIP and general admission tickets are available at citywinery.com. Finger on the Pulse of City Winery, we'd like to thank our sponsors, Heritage Foods USA, New York Magazine, Reka Vodka, Sonar, Smile, Guilt City, Sub-Zero, and Wolf. Please come out and join us for a day of fun, food, and dancing. For more information, go to www.fotpnyc.com.